Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name's Heather Neal and I'm at Shakespeare's Globe to find out about the Ford Experiment and Edward's Boys. I'm joined by Patrick Spottiswood, Director of Globe Education, and Perry Mills, Director of a remarkable company of actors, Edward's Boys. The boys in question are all students at King Edward VI School in Stratford-upon-Avon, Shakespeare's school. Perry Mills is deputy head of the school and has been running Edward's Boys since 2003. They've played at the Globe before, last year Lily's Galatea in the then new Sam Wanamaker Playhouse. The Candlelit Theatre, which brings us as close as possible to the experience of seeing a play in an indoor 17th century playhouse. And their high quality acting, understanding of the text and brilliant timing astonished people then. They've also performed at the universities of Warwick and Oxford, the Swan Theatre in Stratford, Middle Temple Hall and elsewhere. And this week, John Ford's play, The Lady's Trial, published in 1639, is getting its first full-scale production for 400 years. Well, before we hear any more detail about Edward's Boys with Perry, Patrick, can you tell us something about what the Ford experiment has been at the Globe? Because this is kind of the icing on the cake, isn't it? This is topping it off.
Yes, this is the culmination of a sort of a 5 or 6 month exploration of John Ford's work, and in the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse in the last winter season and under Dominic Drumgoole, they staged The Broken Heart and Tis Pity She's a Whore, and we thought we'd use that as a springboard to explore some of those lesser known plays, the ones that just never get done, as part of our ongoing Red Not Dead experiment, which we started back in 1995, and it's there to record with professional casts all of the plays extant by Shakespeare's contemporaries, those that just preceded him and those who came after him. And this has been part of a season called Shakespeare Inspired, and we looked not only at plays or sources which inspired Shakespeare, but Shakespeare is a source of inspiration for other playwrights. And John Ford, I have to say, is you know, probably couldn't have written a thing if it hadn't been for Shakespeare's plays. That's not to say he was a plagiarist or that he was ideas redundant. He just reworked, reimagined, reshaped, reforged, and out of absolute adoration, I think, and love for Shakespeare. But he was using Shakespeare to take his theatre audiences in these candlelit playhouses on a different sort of journey and to surprise them. So we've had staged readings of those well-known plays like Fancy's Chaste and Noble, that I'm sure we all have by our bedside tables, and The Queen and Love Sacrifice, which of course received a full production at the RSC. It's been a kind of Ford year, hasn't it?
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's the context, and we're ending this weekend. Sadly, we had we're saying goodbye to Ford for a bit. We had a fantastic study day yesterday. There was a lot of public appetite to learn more about Ford and the theatre of his time. And then we had this full house in the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse, who just sort of gave a kind of standing ovation to the boys for an absolutely remarkable performance of The Lady's Trial, which, as you said, no one has had the privilege or pleasure of seeing for too many years.
And I'm really looking forward to seeing it later. Perry, tell us how you work with these boys, because you're actually a full-time teacher, aren't you? And you seem to be an impresario as well.
A full-time teacher, I don't think my colleagues would see it that way. Yeah, I'm deputy head at the school, and of course, inevitably, I teach less. I'm in the classroom less, but as deputy head, I've got a lot of admin roles and overseeing some of the public events and dealing with parents and issues. So, yeah, it is a full-time job. I'm extremely lucky with the support I receive from my colleagues at school. I'm extremely lucky that, given the kind of school it is, which is an all-boys grammar school up to the age of 16, and then we've got girls in the sixth form as well, I'm working with bright, enthusiastic, highly motivated students. So I'm really lucky in that sense. But also, I suppose the other thing is that I've been a teacher for about 30 years, and I've always done plays. So if I've learned anything over those years, it's how to take a few shortcuts, and experience helps out. So, it's very busy, and I probably should include my wife in my thanks there, who's very long-suffering. But it's become a very important part of the school. I mean, it's a part of the school, it's not separate from the school. Boys do aspire to be involved in the plays, and when they do them, on the whole, they'd like to carry on. So one of the things we have, and we might talk a little bit more about this later on, is a kind of natural apprenticeship. So we get younger boys joining the company. They can join at any age, but joining the company, and then they carry on and do more and more. So in the sense of how do we pack it in, that's how we pack it in, being very organised. If you mean how do you work in terms of getting the things off the ground, I'm fundamentally an English teacher. I don't have any drama training as such. So anything I've learnt about doing plays has been through acting in them years ago and then starting to direct. So I approach everything from language. So early rehearsals would look just like an English lesson. I find it amusing, and so do the boys, that when we've gotten a rehearsal and I turn up at the rehearsal room, usually a few minutes late because I've had to deal with something else, they are all sitting around a table and they've got their texts out.
Most directors start like that anyway.
I'd really like to think so. Sometimes when you see a production, you don't quite believe that is always the case. But yeah, we do text bashing.
Yeah.
Endless text bashing, and we never put it on its feet until everybody knows exactly what they're saying. We have this phrase about what the text means or what it might mean. And particularly when you come to a playwright like Ford and a play like The Lady's Trial, what it might mean is really important because there's so much disagreement about what lines might mean. There are various reasons for that, partly I think because psychologically he is so subtle and elusive. But also because he's writing big sentences and it's hard to take apart.
You said impresario, and I think it's really neat that because in a way that's a sort of historical accuracy that the original boys' companies they had masters who were impresarios one of the things I always notice and always comment on when I see Perry with his cast is that these are a group of young teenagers, but as soon as Perry walks in the room, they are. He's both director, but he's also the master. And there is a kind of innate obedience, silence, and respect. And it's mutual respect. Oh, yeah. I think that it's not, domination. But it's mutual respect. And I think that's fascinating to watch, because I see other young companies or youth theatres, and they don't quite have that. They don't have that same relationship with the director. So in that sense, it's one of the reasons we're so excited about working with the Edwards boys, is it's allowing us to explore the boys' repertory.
Yes.
But also from a single school, from a group that know each other. I think that's really important. Yeah.
As they would have done.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about what the original boys' companies were like, because there were early Elizabethan ones, weren't there? This play obviously is much later, published in 1639. And so they had a sort of revival, didn't they? They started off as sort of... Paul's boys were the first ones, weren't they?
Yes, we of course at the Globe celebrate the first theatre ever, which was the theatre of Shoreditch from 1576, whose timbers helped build the Globe. But in 1575, there was a playhouse in the yard of St. Paul's.
Yeah.
So I'm not an expert. We had the wonderful Lucy Monroe speaking yesterday, who is the expert, a world expert on children's company and child actors of the time. And we did acknowledge right at the beginning that this play, and as you note, 1630 is, it's a late 1630s play, was done by the Beeston boys. And that's why I asked Perry if he would tackle this play, kind of out of ignorance on my part, because I thought Beeston boys were boys. But in fact, they were, Lucy helped me out yesterday a bit, my reputation, by saying that the notion of what a youth was then actually went up to about 28. But it was a much older company than the boys of the Elizabethan companies. But they still did have some of those young boys. Yeah. And you have some older boys.
Absolutely right. I mean, it's quite interesting. Some members of the audience were saying to me afterwards last night, this one and this one and this one. And are they masters at the school? No, they're not.
Yeah.
They're sixth formers. But one of the things is that experience, I was talking about my experience, some of those older boys that they were talking about have been in nine plays of this period by Ford, but Lilly and Marston and Marlowe and Decker and Webster. And I think some of the Globe actors, some of the RSC actors would struggle to be in as many of those plays.
Yeah.
So they have a kind of experience, yeah, and I hope a bit of talent and quality as well, so that they appeared older than their years.
And the older boys are nurturing the younger, yeah, boys as well. Yeah. I mean, that's another form about a company that's works together all the, yeah, time, yeah, the ensemble nature,
well,
of a school.
About sort of, yeah, apprenticeship that comes,
mm-hmm,
by,
yeah. And I was talking about how lucky I am, and one of the lucky things is that I have time. So a boy might come and be in year 7, so he might be 11 or 12, and then work in maybe on the fringes of the company, in sense of having a very small role. But it depends on the play, because as Patrick has seen, sometimes you know, the key part in the play is a very young boy. But they will then do 2 or 3 plays and then start to get their feet under the table, and they will be learning, I hope, a bit from me, but it's primarily from the boys. I mean, we're talking now, and the older boys are downstairs in the theatre running some warm-up sessions for me, and they're much better at it than I am. So that apprenticeship works in all sorts of ways, and that support network, it's really nice to... A parent was acting as chaperone backstage last night, and she was saying this morning she just couldn't believe how supportive they were of each other, and watching each other's scenes and patting themselves on the back. You know, one would like to think that happens all the time, but it's certainly they take it very seriously. But obviously,
are they a kind of elite within the school? How do they get into the company?
I'd like to think not elite. How it happens is that, as I say, on the whole, when boys join, they want to carry on doing it. Mm. Every now and then, for different reasons, maybe because they're very busy or they happen to be a top sportsman and really they can't find the time, then they might not carry on. But on the whole, they tend to carry on. So I'm looking to replenish the stock, as it were, like a sort of trout farm. And it's often the younger ones, but it can be somebody that I've just come across. I, as deputy head, you know, one of my responsibilities is things like assemblies and carol services and things like that. And I like training the kids to do their presentations and performances, and that's great, because if I'm doing an assembly and I ask somebody, would you like to help me with a poem? After we've done a short rehearsal, we know whether we get on, and that might be fine. If I opened auditions across the school, I know I would be flooded with all,
yes,
sorts of people.
Yes.
But one of the things is, I mean, people are very complimentary, and I hope you enjoy the performances this evening, but they're not the best actors in the world. They're not even necessarily the best actors in the school. They've got to be the right kind of person, and the right kind of person, or awful lot of the lads you'll see are not only in plays, they do a whole range of things, particularly sport. And I like sport, and the sporting element, that teamwork, collaboration, is utterly central to the way we work. So we expect to help each other out and work together. So it may be that he's not the finest actor. He'll work really hard and he'll get it right, but what he will do is support the company, and that's the right kind of person.
Well, I suppose most of the boys in the company will have to play a woman or a girl at some point. How do they
call it a rite of passage?
Right.
They do, yeah, they do. They right from the very beginning, when we did our first full play, the invitation of Patrick, we were conference exploring how boys play female roles. And we chose to do The Dutch Courtesan by John Marston. And that's a play that's obviously about sex and female characters sometimes in highly erotic scenes. And we talked about how we were going to do it. And there was
no... Didn't start with an easy one.
No, we didn't, nor was it easy linguistically. I remember Patrick's sharing a story with me. You knew it at university and you hadn't realised there were any puns in it.
No, I had. I went to a production which hadn't. I don't think they realised that, you know. No, we won't go there. No,
part of the attraction for boys is that these plays are often very bloody and full of filth. So, yeah, you know, why would they not want to do them? But the whole question of how you represent women and how the school perceives it, and that was... Initially, we had no idea how it would be accepted. We don't do camp. We don't send it up unless the scene demands it. And when we did Dutch Courtesan, the very first performance was in Shakespeare's schoolroom back in Stratford prior to bringing it to London. There were audible gasps when the first scene took place that had boys dressed as girls. It was the brothel madam and the courtesan coming on. And the parents and members of staff think, what on earth is going on? And it was pretty full on. But by Act Two, those gasps or giggles disappeared, and they were laughing in the right places. Mm. And when the courtesan, Francesina, she's treated appallingly in that play. Mm. And you could just tell that they were going with the story. So you know, the classic Q&A question to one of our boys is, you know, what's it like, and challenging your sexuality, or you know, at this point in adolescence, this is difficult. And they will always just shrug and say, it's just a part. Mm. It's just a part. Yeah. You know, they're as keen to play a girl as they are to play a king or a lord or a soldier. It's an acting exercise. You know, I'm just a boy underneath, or you know, it doesn't matter if I wear a dress or not. And as I say, it's a rite of passage. They, one of the older ones in an interview recently said, you really can't take the mick out of anybody else because you know at some point you're going to do it. So you can't afford to.
Everyone goes through it.
Absolutely, so it's a respect thing. I mean, take for example a kiss, which is something that's always going to be contentious within the context we're talking about. We talk about it. We first of all have to work out what kind of kiss is it, because there's a whole ranging from perhaps a kiss on the back of a hand as a mark of respect through to something that might be erotic. And if you're dealing with courtesans, it probably is. We work out what is necessary, and then we work out the way that we should do it to convey the effect. And you'll see a kiss in the production this evening. Yeah. And I would like to think that is a kiss of great power and purity.
I remember, yes, when I first saw the company, I kind of wondered about how the audience would respond, how I would respond, you know. I don't give a second thought now. It's interesting, 8 years later, I suppose.
No.
But I think what's so lovely is Perry, that you're exploring the boys' repertory. So yeah. You're not, you know, doing the school Shakespeare production. I mean, to this day, remember the best Rosalind I ever saw. It was a 15-year-old boy called Benedict Cumberbatch. I don't know what happened to him. He played Rosalind, and he was brilliant. But, you know, the school Shakespeare is what I did, the school Shakespeare. Yeah, but the fact that you're exploring these lesser-known plays that were written specifically for boys is the great adventure for me.
Why
I think it's incredibly brave. You know, adult companies won't take on the ladies' trial, and yet you have.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, and I think that's a great mission.
Is that the reason it hasn't been done for so long, do you think, that people just...
Assume it's a boys' play?
Yeah.
No, I think it is a tricky play.
There are weaknesses.
And you know, how many Fords can you do? And when somebody does decide to do a Ford, they do the Broken Heart, or usually Tis Pity, She's
Pity. Yeah.
And well, I think we probably ought to say something about this play, because you said that Ford probably wouldn't have written anything if it hadn't been for Shakespeare. He was particularly keen on Othello, wasn't he?
Yeah, so many of his plays take Othello.
He sort of subverts Othello in this one.
Yes, I mean, yes, subverts or just takes Othello on a journey.
Yes,
I think, and you're always aware of, well, you're not always. I mean, there are lots. You know, you're picking up references occasionally, subliminal maybe, to a lot of Shakespeare plays.
Yeah, yeah.
And you, Perry, had the great fortune to work with Lisa Hopkins, who's edited this play and has edited the play for the Oxford Complete Ford, and that's been remarkable. You know, we had. I mean, the boys yesterday had the editor who'd never seen the play before.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which is great. And then Professor Sir Brian Vickers, the general editor of the Oxford Complete Ford, you know, and Martin Wiggins, another editor. I mean, you know, it's incredible. And they're amazed by these performances, and amazed to be able and feel privileged to be actually, you know, they're working on these plays, you know, on the page, struggling with commas, semicolons, and original spelling, and to actually have them just lifted off the page by the boys is a great excitement.
I probably shouldn't say this, but a colleague of mine was sitting next to both Martin and Brian during the performance, and he said he could hear them muttering under their breath to each other. Yeah,
but
right.
I think what Lisa said so eloquently, you know, she's supported a lot of our Ford Red Not Dead, as has Sir Brian and Martin. But she said, you know, as a scholar, it's if you haven't seen a play, you don't know its performance tradition, it's really difficult to read humour. And you read comic scenes and you think, oh my goodness, these are so far from comic. Mm. How dire is this comedy? Mm. And then you see it performed and the comedy is wickedly funny and the comedy works. And I think that's been a revelation, I think, to the four
characters. There are three plots in this play. Yes. And
I think it is about time we
let's talk about this play. There are three plots. And let's start with the comic plot, the most obviously comic plot, which is just full of casual racism. We're asked to laugh at a silly Spaniard and a silly Dutchman. And Lisa was really worried about whether it would come off the page, as you say. And I hope we're successful. You saw it last time, and the audience certainly found those scenes very funny. It's interesting because we do still have just a vestige of tradition, I think, of laughing at Spaniards, you know, Jim Broadbent in Blackadder or whatever
But there's a little bit of Don Amado.
Don Amado and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The Dutch, that's a bit more difficult for us because we don't have those associations unless we're thinking about Louis van Gaal's back four formation. But it's more difficult, I think. And I hope George's performance as the Dutchman Fulgoso makes some sort of sense as well. But they went down well. And basically, they're two rival suitors for the hand of the young woman who happens to have the worst lisp in the world. And that's another interesting thing, because as we started, there's a sudden shock for the boys that you can't laugh at people with disabilities. This is totally wrong. Well, they realise that, yes, we can within the world of the play, and actually it goes down very well, which again you were kind enough to laugh at last night. There's always go for the cheapest laugh. I'd like to talk a bit, if I can, about the main plot.
Yes, please do. In
a sense, that's the purest Ford, I think, from the bit I've got to understand. It's this is the Othello story rewritten and re-examined, and the great man, he's not a general, and he's certainly not a lord, he's a gentleman, Aurea, an older man, marries at the beginning of the play the beautiful young Spinella. And so there you've got the Othello Desdemona story. And he has to leave to go and fight in the wars. And his friend, Aurelio, which is another way in which Ford doesn't help us out, the two main characters, Aurea and Aurelio. His friend Aurelio says to him as soon as he got married, this is a real mistake. You know what it's like. You know, beautiful young women, you're bound to have a problem. And now you're going away. It's just a terrible idea. So the seed is kind of planted then.
That she's going to be tempted
and be unfaithful. You know what women are like, he says. And then while the husband's away, Spinella perfectly innocently accepts an invitation to the house of a lord with a bit of a reputation for the ladies. But she goes to go and view his etchings, his gallery. And of course, while she's there, he makes an improper advance, which she shuns. Mm. And there is absolutely no question. She's not tempted at all. She's horrified. She wishes her husband was there to protect her. But at that very moment, this friend bursts into the room and discovers them together, not even in a compromising position. They're in a room together. And he puts two and two together and makes 29. And there is the problem. So when Aurea returns, Aurelio tells him that this is what he found, and you know what that means. So it's very interesting because, you know, what would Othello do? Well, Othello gets jealous and so on. Aurea doesn't react in that way at all. Mm. Things become, as I was touching on with Ford, become submerged, and his reaction is deceptive and surprising and odd. I mean, it's a very strange play. You know, that moment when the friend tells his friend his wife has been unfaithful to him, that is such a great moment. Ford doesn't stage it. That happens off stage. What we see is the consequences of it. And the friend is saying, why aren't you reacting? Why didn't you look for revenge? And the husband said, what do I need to revenge? She's done nothing. So it's about, you know, the peculiar sort of dark, strange ways that human beings do react. I find it, and I know this is potentially a stupid phrase, I use them all the time, I find it a really modern play, because instead of people reacting in grand, huge gestures, complicated reactions to things, mixed reactions to things, and uncertain reactions to things. And it's an absolutely fascinating story. I did say earlier on at this the things that Aurelio was saying about women. I think across the three plots in the play, it's asking us to look at how men regard women. And I find it hugely critical of the male vision of women. So not that they hate them.
It is very interesting. Yeah. But there's a second plot, isn't there?
Yeah, a third one, one in between.
One
yeah.
In between.
Yeah. And in some ways, the main plot is fascinating. But in some ways, I find this second plot, the one in between, even more interesting. A woman called Levadolci is married to a man called Benazzi. Benazzi is from a lower class. He's clearly
it's
a kind
it's
of
set in Genoa. That's why
Genoa.
These terrible names.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, yeah, Genoa, and in 1638, so it's a sort of contemporary piece for Ford, and Levadolci casts her husband aside and chooses to have a sexual relationship with Aderni, the young lord who actually later moves on to Spinella. This happens before the play begins, and Benazzi shoots off to the wars, of course, as you would. the same wars that Aurea goes to. But so at the beginning of the play, Levadolci is without a man, but she's just about to move on to another one. She sends him a letter of invitation. Now, he shuns her. He is disgusted because he knows her reputation. Everybody's talking about this woman and Aderni, the lord. So it's terrible. Her attitude is extraordinary. She appears to say, okay, if you call me a whore, I'll be a whore. What are you going to do about it? That's, for me, that, again, is strikingly modern. She's asserting her independence in a way that really wrongfoots the men. Benazzi comes back from the wars, and he's heard about his wife's behaviour. He comes in disguise. But, of course, he meets Levadolci, his previous wife. And she's in disguise, and guess what happens when they meet in disguise? So there's an extremely complicated romantic plot that occurs between them, and we've found it really interesting. I haven't yet spoken to Patrick about that plot. I'd love to know what you thought, because there are elements that are so dark and disturbing in that story, and elements that the audience seem to find very funny as well.
Yes. I think the other thing I'd just say about Ford is that whereas with Shakespeare, this is probably a horrible generalisation, I'm going to be shot down in flames for it, but you kind of always know where you are in the story. And you often are given privileged information through soliloquy that help, you know, so you have almost superior knowledge to a lot of the characters in the play. I don't find that with Ford. With Ford, as an audience member, I remember when I was reading Ford, a lot of Ford, I would, you know, go and make a coffee and I'd come back and, did I miss a scene? Because there was information missing.
Oh, yes.
And so you're constantly glimpsing in and trying to work it out, and you're seeing it from different perspectives. So you never have that sort of kind of glorious certainty that you do more with, I think, the Shakespeare stories, with Shakespeare's plots.
That's,
I don't know if
you... flattery, but that's such a perceptive point, because there is a moment in this play that I find unique in drama of this period, but you know, my experience is so limited. But there is a moment when Aurea is making up the next stage of the plot, and he's on stage thinking aloud, but he's stopping telling, he will not tell the other people on stage, or Aurelio, his friend, and he says, no, I must think, he says. Now in a Shakespeare play, you might expect him then to turn to us and say, this is what I'm going to do. But he doesn't even tell the audience.
No.
He says something like, now if I do this and this, oh, and then that, and that, So the audience says, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And even when he does it, we're not certain.
I think that's one of the great excitements of Ford.
Yes.
And probably why he's difficult to read. On the page, therefore another reason why he's not done, because directors and dramaturgs don't have much time, you know, to select their plays. So they go, as I say, they go back to the tried and the tested, the ones that have a theatre tradition. I mean, because they feel they you know, they've also got a box office tradition.
Exactly, audiences recognise
the titles.
Yeah.
I mean,
Do the boys find playing comedy more difficult than the darker scenes?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I wish I had a few
boys to
hear. And we must. I'm sorry. I don't find that the case.
Well,
at
I mean,
all.
You can tell by the result. I mean, if they make you laugh, they've got it.
Yeah,
haven't they?
Absolutely.
I mean, sometimes, you know, young people know about angst,
but they don't necessarily know about
showing other people
the
how
display
to
of comedy. Yeah. I thought the two lads were brilliant.
Thank you very much.
And I think displaying
you know, in Galatea, you saw them play the comedy as well. I mean, I think we just approach every scene on its merits. That sounds a bit glib, but we look how can we bring out whatever we think is in this scene. And I think it was Peter Hall who said sort of 95% of the success of a production is in the casting. So I mean, I think now you would say the two guys who are playing the comic roles, you know, they are quite good comic actors.
Yep.
So they were comfortable with it in the way that maybe some of the rest of the cast I wouldn't, just as casting ones to play boys.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it's not always the smallest, the one with the unbroken voice and so on, who play the female roles. I think you'll find it that tonight, the Spinella, he's 16 and he's got a broken voice. And you can tell he's a boy when we want you to think of him as a boy, but he has the ability, you'd agree, Patrick, to look and behave in a female way. And I think that's part of the fascination of the experiment now, the project now. Because you get different stories from an actress playing.
Presumably, in Beeston's Boys, there would have been someone, probably, who was
someone
you could take to be a girl when you needed, or or a young man otherwise.
Absolutely. I think these insights...
It was meant to be partly provocative as well, wasn't it? I mean, there was sort of...
Yeah, and that's another thing that the people have said, particularly in the early days, and Patrick referred to Dutch Courtesan about how he was going to react and other audience members. And that is an interesting thing. You know, I'm deputy head in the school, and this is potentially provocative material, and how do we do it? I mean, we try to approach it in a mature way. That doesn't mean that we don't have lots of laughs in rehearsals and so on, but then things put away in the box. We try not to be sexist in our own attitudes. I think, you know, fundamentally I'm a teacher, so actually talking about the position of women and how women were used and exploited in sex trade and those sorts of things are an important part of people's education. So I think that's very important. But then we've got to tell the story.
Yeah.
And then allow the audience to decide these things.
I'm getting a bit worried now because it's time that you went back to
make
sure that they're all right.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
So thank you very much for giving us the time before it
Absolute pleasure. I hope you enjoy the show.
Yeah, thank you very much. Looking forward to it.